Thank you, Denny. Good to have you all here. We have a few more here than we did during the class time. Great to see you all. We were talking in the earlier session about archaeology, especially as related to the Gospels, but I'd like to expand that a little bit and talk about archaeology as it relates to the Bible as a whole. I remember many years ago there was an article called The Bible and Archaeology in Time magazine, which is not a conservative publication, but there was a statement made in that article that I like. Quote, recent explorations in Palestine have demonstrated that the Bible is much more surprisingly accurate than former generations had imagined. If you believe in the verbally inspired Word of God, the Bible, then you're not surprised when you see that it's accurate. But I think it's refreshing occasionally when the people in the unbelieving world at least give a nodding tribute to the accuracy of the material we have in the Bible. Archaeology as a science is less than 200 years old. The first scientific exploration of the land of Israel was in about the 1830s. Edward Robinson investigated some biblical sites, but at that time, only about 150 of these places in the whole land had been concretely identified. Now we have thousands and thousands and thousands of sites that have been rather conclusively identified with their biblical names. Tremendous advancements have been made in archaeology, and there's much more to be discovered in the future, if the world stands, than we have discovered to this point. More than 6,000 sites have been identified. Probably less than a few hundred of those, though, have been studied with any degree of precision. There's just a lot more to do. Over the past century and a half, at least 500,000 clay tablets have been discovered, written in the cuneiform style, meaning impressions made in the clay while it was damp, and then it's allowed to harden and becomes a rather permanent record. Of these 500,000 tablets, only a minority percentage have been translated so far. So there are still multiplied thousands untranslated over in London that are just waiting for people to get to them. You can have a lot of excitement in anticipation of what secrets might come out of what we've already discovered but haven't figured out yet. A few years ago, a man by the name of Donald Wiseman was translating in the basement of the British Museum, and he discovered some records concerning King Jehoiakim. This was at the time of the second deportation of the Jews into the Babylonian captivity. He discovered the actual day of the month that Jehoiakim was captured and taken to Babylon. The food rations were mentioned for the king and his family, mentioned right in those tablets that are not a part of the Bible at all, but yet they just go hand in glove. They dovetail together with exactly the information we have in the Old Testament. Only a fractional sampling of the things available have been discovered and deciphered at this point. But this morning I'd like to begin by talking about four different areas in which the Bible helps us, or the archaeology helps us in our understanding of the Bible. Archaeology enhances our learning and appreciation for the text of the Bible. For instance, number one, there has been considerable advancement in our understanding of the Bible's chronology, the way that events take in chronological relationship to each other. We don't know as much about the chronology of the Old Testament as we would like to. We don't have an absolute chronology of the Old Testament. It's impossible for us to make one because we don't have quite enough information. Over the past half century, I've probably examined 40 different chronologies of the Old Testament. And I say different because they're all different from each other because we don't have quite enough information. But archaeology is helping us fill in some of the gaps. As you know, the Bible is filled with dates and statistical matter concerning the reigns of kings and so forth. These have to be of some value, else why did God give them to us? There's nothing in the Bible that's just there to fill space. So what is the significance of the chronological data in the Bible? Well, it has to do with the unique nature of the biblical revelation, because the Christian faith, unlike many of the so-called religions of the world, is grounded in history. If there'd been a clock running back at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus, it would have been registering time, just like time is registered now. There are many religions that have no concern with history whatsoever. Buddhism, for example, is not in the least concerned with history. You can be a faithful Buddhist and not even believe that the Buddha actually existed in time and space. And you're just fine with that. Confucianism is somewhat that way. As I've said before, you can take Confucius out of Confucianism and you still won't be confused because he's not integral to the religion that he himself established. But if you take Jesus Christ out, if you take the historical record concerning him away, then you're left with nothing but a house of cards that folds because Christianity is grounded in history. The Christian faith is grounded in historical events, and important to historical events are the dates that they happen and how they intertwine with one another, with the political and religious systems of the ancient world. So chronology is a very important biblical subject. In 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, we see that Solomon started building the temple project in the fourth year of his reign, which was 480 years after the Exodus. In other words, approximately 966 B.C. The Exodus was in the middle of the 15th century B.C. Now, critics have said for years that the Exodus didn't occur then. Ed and I were talking about that just a minute ago, some of the modern archaeological information that's been put together by David Roll, and others have worked on this as well. He showed us that although critics have said for many years that the Exodus did not occur at the time that the Bible says that it did, rather it occurred a couple hundred years later in the 13th century. The question was sharply drawn for a long time, but archaeology has established now that the 15th century is correct, the same thing the Bible said all the time. Bible chronology is an extremely important aspect of archaeological study. If it can be established that the chronology of the Bible is accurate when it's checkable, then it's easier to assume that it's also accurate in places where it's not checkable. Our faith and our confidence in it grows. The faith that comes by hearing the Word of God is expanded as we see that it connects with things that are not in the Bible and is shown to be verified. The Bible teaches, for instance, that humanity reaches back to the beginning of the creation. In Genesis chapter 1, we're told that man was created on the sixth day. In Mark chapter 10, verse 6 in the New Testament, Jesus endorsed this. From the beginning of the creation, he said, God made them male and female. So, is man as old as the earth or not? The evolutionary system, of course, says no. The evolutionary system, and the numbers keep changing in this, but they'll say that the universe is approximately 20 billion years old, that the earth is 5 billion years old, but man is only 3 million years old. That's just a tiny fraction of the existence of the earth. But if we know that the Bible is in every checkable instance shown to be true, then biblical chronology has been proven true in many areas, then our confidence grows to believe that man has existed on the earth ever since the earth has existed, or within 6 days of the existence of the earth. It's a place where it's not checkable, but yet it's easier to believe if we understand that where the Bible has been shown to be checkable, it's been shown to be right. So chronology is one big area. Another big area is in the locating of places that had been lost for many years. Clifford Wilson, an Australian archaeologist, located the city of Ma'rib, the capital city of the kingdom of Sheba that's mentioned in the Old Testament. Remember, the Queen of Sheba was said to come and visit Solomon. She brought valuable gifts to him. She saw the splendor of his kingdom. She said, the half hath not been told. My breath was taken away by everything that I have seen here. Well, is that myth or is that history? Many people have concluded years ago and have believed for years that it's just myth. Critics of the Bible for generations suggested that it was just invented to highlight the reign of Solomon, to give it some flavor, to spruce it up, to give it a little pizzazz. But that puts Jesus in an embarrassing light. In light of Matthew 12, where Jesus himself said and showed that he believed that the king of the south came from the end of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here, he said, referring to himself as being a greater than Solomon. Well, these two explorers in the 1800s in the northwest part of Arabia came to the town of Marib. They discovered some undecipherable inscriptions. They couldn't read them, but they took impressions of them at a risk of their own lives because they were harassed by the authorities there. They were forced to flee. They went back to Europe with these inscriptions that they had taken copies of, and they found scholars who could read them, and it was discovered that Marib was the capital city of the ancient kingdom of Sheba. It's not a mythological city at all. The Queen of Sheba was a literal monarch who actually ruled, and she ruled in the time of Solomon. Also, there is, in archaeology, we have been shown that it will clear up controversies that we had over biblical statements. In the book of Genesis, chapter 40, we read that Joseph was in prison. Very famous story. Even our children know it. Joseph was in prison, and there he encountered a man called a butler, the king's butler, and a man called the king's baker. And he interpreted dreams for them. The butler's dream showed the picking of grapes and the squeezing of the juice into the king's cup. And the clear implication was that grape growing was a part of the agriculture of Egypt. This butler wouldn't have known anything about grapes and squeezing wine into a cup unless he had had grapes to work with. But Herodotus, the so-called father of ancient Greek history, wrote that Moses made a mistake there, that grapes were not grown in Egypt at that time, nor for many centuries afterward. In recent years, hieroglyphics from Egypt, from Joseph's time period, says that grapes were being grown and that wine was being produced and drunk at the time of Joseph. Archaeology has been a willing witness for the integrity of the Genesis account. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 16, Abraham and Sarah, because of a famine down in Canaan, were forced to migrate further down into Egypt. The Pharaoh became infatuated with Sarah, Abraham's wife. He wanted her for his harem, even though she was 90 years old. She must have been remarkably well preserved. And the Pharaoh, after taking Sarah for his own, but not consummating anything, but taking her for his own, he was shown by God through a number of things that happened that this was not right. And to buy them off and get Abraham and his people out of there, the Pharaoh gave them several precious gifts, including camels. But the critics said there were no camels in Egypt at that time. And this was widely believed. R.H. Pfeiffer wrote a very popular textbook on the Old Testament stating that this was a clear biblical mistake because there were no camels in Egypt at the time of Abraham. But in recent years, discovery after discovery has come to light, where we have found camel hair ropes down in the sands of Egypt. We have found pottery in the shape of camels. We have even found camel bones. So many silent witnesses from the Egyptian sands have testified on behalf of the accuracy of the biblical record. In Isaiah chapter 20, verse 1, we read about a king called Sargon, king of Assyria. Sargon sent Tartan, his commander-in-chief, against the city of Ashdod. Ashdod has been in the news recently as the Palestinian and Israeli war has been going on. Ashdod has been mentioned quite frequently in news reports, so everybody now knows about where it is down in the Gaza Strip. It was a Philistine city on the Mediterranean coast of Israel. Sargon, according to Isaiah 20, sent Tartan, his commander-in-chief, and he took Ashdod. But until 1843, the name Sargon was not found in any known piece of literature in the entire world except Isaiah chapter 20, verse 1. Just one time in the Bible, and nowhere else outside of the Bible was Sargon mentioned. So, of course, the assumption always has to be that the Bible is wrong. Never give the Bible the benefit of the doubt. This was an obvious historical error, and even some Bible-believing people said so. Sargon never lived. And then we found the Library of Nineveh. In it was discovered more than 50,000 clay tablets, and among those clay tablets were the records of King Sargon. He's now one of the best-known monarchs of the Assyrian Empire. His records had the records of the invasion of the city of Ashdod, and it turns out that the Bible was absolutely right. And the exact word for commander-in-chief, Tartan, was used in that text. The exact military term that's found in the Bible there was found in the records of King Sargon. Around 1965, the University of Pennsylvania was doing some archaeological excavation at Ashdod, and they discovered on that site records of Sargon's invasion. So we have an independent witness from the west in Ashdod and another one from the east in Nineveh, both corroborating the veracity of the statement that Isaiah made 700 years before Christ. It's kind of an amazing thing to think about. In 2 Kings chapter 18, also Isaiah 37, which is the parallel passage, we read about another Assyrian king there by the name of Sennacherib. And it talks about Sennacherib's invasion of Israel. They marched in and they conquered a number of fortified cities. They marched right up to the edge of Jerusalem and they surrounded it, which is the way they did warfare in the days before we had airplanes. Now you can fly over and drop bombs. But in those days, they would just surround the city and choke the life out of it, keep food from coming in and so forth. So it was called compassing a city about. That's what King Sennacherib did. With his army, he compassed the city of Jerusalem about, but he did not take Jerusalem. The records of Sennacherib were also discovered in Assyria. They mentioned this invasion of Israel that's mentioned in the Bible during the period of King Hezekiah. In fact, King Hezekiah of Judah is called by name in Sennacherib's records. The Old Testament does not say how many cities of Judah were subjugated by Sennacherib, but he states in his records that he conquered 46 fortified cities of Judah. This was before the time of the Babylonian captivity. God was using the Assyrians to punish the people of Judah, even as he had used them to take the northern kingdom, used the Assyrians to take the northern kingdom of Israel into Assyrian captivity. He's using the Assyrians to punish the people of Judah also, and then the Babylonians will later take them into captivity. But in those records, Sennacherib said that he marched against Jerusalem. He says, quote, "I shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage in his city Jerusalem," end quote. So he tells us that he conquered 46 fortified cities, and then he says he shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage in his city Jerusalem, but he never tells us that he took Jerusalem. Why doesn't Sennacherib tell us in his records that he took Jerusalem? But what was it that happened at Jerusalem? Well, it's the Old Testament that tells us what really happened. The Assyrian army came in, they compassed the city of Jerusalem about, and then the messenger of Jehovah, the angel of the Lord, went through the Assyrian camp in one night, and the next morning 185,000 Assyrian soldiers lay dead. They were all smitten by the angel of the Lord. Sennacherib was over at Lachish a few miles away when he heard the news that his army was all dead, and based on that, he decided that it was a good time to pick up and go back home to Nineveh. And that explains why the city of Jerusalem was never taken by the Assyrians. Herodotus recognized that something amazing had happened, and so he tried to explain it by saying that on that night, a plague of rats swept through the Assyrian camps, and they ate the bowstrings and the quivers, so when morning came, they were unable to do battle without their weapons, and that's why they fled back to Nineveh. It was a ridiculous perversion of the historical truth, but at least it gives credence to the fact that something dramatic happened there and had to be explained in some way. The Bible tells us the truth about it, that God just slaughtered that army where they lay there on the ground. He wasn't ready for Jerusalem to be taken yet. A fourth area is that archaeology has shed light on the interpretation of difficult passages, and this is especially true in the Old Testament. I want to point out that there's nothing in the Bible that's essential to salvation that's difficult for us to understand. We are not indebted to one single archaeological item for how to become a Christian, for how to worship God acceptably or for how to live a life remaining faithful to the Lord. That's all very clear. We don't need archaeology for any of that. But in many passages, especially in the Old Testament, we have some shrouding in obscurity of antiquity. We just don't know exactly what was being said there. But archaeology has helped to illuminate the meaning of some of these things. For instance, in Deuteronomy chapter 34, right, the last chapter of Deuteronomy, Moses goes up to the top of Mount Nebo and he dies there because he is not being allowed to enter the Promised Land. The people are just ready to go over into the Promised Land, crossing the Jordan River. Moses is not going to be allowed to go because of his sin in the wilderness where he took God's glory to himself. The Bible tells us that Moses was 120 years old, that his eye was not dim, nor was his natural force abated. That same old eagle eye that had looked into the eye of Pharaoh when he said, "Jehovah says, let my people go," was just still as operative as before. His eyesight had not dimmed at all. Nor was his natural force abated. Now, for years, we did not know what that meant, that his natural force was abated. The Hebrew word translated natural force there is not found anywhere else in the Bible, so we don't have anything else to compare it to. Fairly close to a Hebrew word meaning jaw was found. So Jerome, who translated the Latin Vulgate in the 4th century, said that maybe Moses still had all his teeth because it's like the word jaw here. That was a nice try, but it was wrong. In recent years, from the Rosh Shamra tablets at Ugarit in Syria, just north of Israel, the same expression, natural force, has been found twice. And the meaning is the ability of a man to sire children. Moses was still physically vigorous enough to be able to beget children, even when he was 120 years old. The point that's being made there in the text is that Moses didn't go up in that mountain and die because he was a decrepit old man. He still had the natural force of his body. He still had his eyesight like it had always been. God had preserved this because he was the leader of Israel. But now it was time for him to die, and Moses died as a temporal consequence of his disobedience to God, as we find recorded in the 20th chapter of the book of Numbers. Doesn't mean that Moses was not saved, but there was a price to be paid for his disobedience. And even though Moses asked God several times to repeal this edict about not being able to go into the Promised Land, God said, "I'm tired of you asking about that. Don't ask about it anymore because you're not going to the Promised Land." To know that what natural force really means there is helpful in us understanding that Moses was a vigorous man even at the age of 120. In the 34th chapter of the book of Exodus, we have a regulation that has puzzled a lot of people. The Israelites were not to boil a kid, that is a young goat, in its mother's milk. You shall not boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. I often wondered as a boy, what is the purpose of that regulation? Adam Clark, who wrote a 6-volume commentary on virtually every verse of the Bible, speculated that this was to develop sensitivity on the part of the children of Israel, that it would seem especially cruel to boil a young goat in the milk that was meant for its nourishment, and he said it was to help the Israelites develop sensitivity. Well, there may be some aspect of that, but I don't think that's the real meaning of it. It would seem, from what we're able to determine through archaeology, that the Canaanites had as one of their methods of appeasing their gods of fertility, that they would boil a kid in its mother's milk. And so apparently, since this was a ceremony that was used by idolatrous peoples, God was trying to protect his people from becoming idolatrous or for having anything to do with these people so the bad would rub off on them. Since these people are doing that, then you're not to boil a kid in its mother's milk. God is instructing them, as he did on numerous occasions, don't imitate the religious practices of your heathen neighbors. God's revealed will is what you're supposed to be doing, and there's a lesson in that for us in our own time. That's a lesson just as modern as today. Archaeology has benefited us there and showed us perhaps some of the reasons behind that regulation. In this time when our faith is intimidated and threatened on every side from so many different sources. Archaeology does help to strengthen our faith in the integrity of God's book. We might ask the question, did Moses really write the Pentateuch at all? A lot of people in our time don't think that he did. We're constantly told, and have been told for hundreds of years now, that Moses lived too early to have written the book, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, which is called the Pentateuch because it's the five books of Moses. We're told that it contains information that Moses could not have known. We're told that many details in these five books come from a later age and then are inserted into Genesis and others. The Pentateuch, we're told, was pieced together from various sources, and they've got four sources. You've heard of the JEPD hypothesis, perhaps, that at a fairly late date, long after Moses' death, these sources, the Jehovah source, the Elohim source, the Deuteronomy source, and the priestly source, were all woven together to complete these books. They were supposedly written at different times by different authors. So the idea that Moses did not write the Pentateuch has been around really for more than 1,000 years. But until the mid-17th century, the vast majority of people still thought Moses wrote it. It's only in our own time now that this has been challenged in the way it's challenged now. In the middle of the 17th century, there was a Dutch philosopher by the name of Spinoza, Benedict Spinoza, who seriously questioned that Moses wrote the Pentateuch. There was also a French physician by the name of Astruc who developed this original documentary hypothesis in 1753. It was revised by Graft. It was restated by Wellhausen in the 19th century. And sometimes it's called the Graft-Wellhausen hypothesis, but most people just refer to it as the JEPD. Anyway, supposedly, all these books were edited together as late as 200 B.C., This is an increasingly popular theory even in our time. Numerous commentaries that you can read on the Pentateuch promote this idea. In many scholarly circles, if you don't believe the JEPD hypothesis, you're considered uneducated and fanatical. But one of the first assumptions that this theory rests on was disproven a long time ago. Can you believe that? One of the first assumptions it rests on was disproven a long time ago because it was assumed in the making up of this hypothesis that Moses lived prior to the time of written language. We've talked before about when writing developed. I think it developed very early. You realize Adam and Eve, or at least Adam, lived almost 1,000 years. I suspect that they developed writing during their lifetime. I can't imagine a marriage where husbands and wife can't leave notes to each other to communicate. When you're going to be gone for a while, you would need to leave a note. These people were far more brilliant than we are. Surely they could develop some sort of a system of symbolic writing. So I think writing developed very early. We can't prove exactly when it developed. But we do know that writing developed long before Moses' time. It used to be said Moses was a primitive man with no alphabet. Now we know that that is not true. The Code of Hammurabi was discovered over 100 years ago at Susa, which is now in Iran. It was written hundreds of years before Moses on a piece of hard black stone almost 8 feet high and contains some laws similar to some of the ones that Moses wrote. Nobody can legitimately any longer say that Moses' laws were too advanced for his time or that Moses could not have been able to write. The Code of Hammurabi goes back to 1726 B.C. And there have been other finds as well showing that writing goes way back before the time of Moses. So, interestingly, one of the foundational principles, one of the foundational assumptions on which this modern theory rests has been shattered years ago. But people still believe the theory, even though one of the pegs has been removed from underneath it that supports it. Numerous references in the Pentateuch are said to be of a later time than Moses, anachronisms which could not possibly be the work of Moses. For instance, they'll say in Genesis 36, which Genesis 36 is probably one of the least studied chapters of Genesis, maybe the least studied chapter in it, because it gives the chronology of Esau. It's basically a bunch of names. But the statement is made at the end of it in Genesis 36:31 that these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. And so the critics will say, see, this was written after there were kings in Israel because the writer knew that there were kings in Israel. The claim is made that this passage could only have been written after the first king began to reign, and of course Moses lived hundreds of years before King Saul, who was the first king of the Hebrew people. But Moses did know about the promises that God had made to Abraham and Jacob concerning the future kings of Israel. Moses did know that God had promised Sarah would be a mother of nations and, quote, kings of peoples shall come from her, Genesis 17, verse 6. Just one chapter before that verse in question in Genesis 36, Jacob was promised that kings will come out of your loins, Genesis 35, verse 11. So Genesis 36, verse 31, saying before the kings of Israel reigned, was written with that promise in mind, and is saying that Edom became a kingdom before Israel did. Moses knew there were going to be kings of Israel, and he had prophesied about that. Esau sold his birthright for a bunch of boiled stew, and he became a kingdom early. His people became a kingdom early. He had everything in hand and very little in promise, while Israel had everything in promise and very little in hand. Moses was inspired by God. He was given special revelation from God. In Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 and 15, he said, "When you, the people of Israel, come into God's land, this land that he's going to give you, you will set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses." So Moses having superior knowledge is not a problem. Rather, it would be expected if he was inspired by God. We would expect him to know some things that were going to happen. We've talked about the camels in the book of Genesis. Actually, there were 23 references to camels in the book of Genesis. It claimed, as we mentioned in the class time, that they were in Egypt in the time of Abraham, that they were in the promised land in the time of Isaac. They were in Padan Aram when Jacob was working for Laban there. They were owned by the Midianites to whom Joseph was sold. So there's a lot about camels in the book of Genesis. But the modern critics claimed still, in some cases, that domesticated camels were unknown in those times. As far as I know, these people are unable to support with one piece of solid evidence that claim that they make. And as I mentioned in the class time, there has evidence been discovered that shows that camels were domesticated during and long before the time of Abraham. I mentioned camel's hair ropes, pottery camels, camel bones, and so forth. But part of the problem here is, and I said all that to say this, part of the problem is that once an idea gets into the literature, then it's almost impossible to get it out even when it's proven wrong. It's hard to shake it out of the literature because somebody will read a textbook and they'll say, "Oh, that sounds pretty good." So they'll put it in their textbook. And the next edition of the textbook continues to have it. We see this with evolutionary principles all the time. Things that have been disproven long ago are still in our children's textbook in our classrooms today. At Hama in Syria, they came across a figurine from the second millennium BC. And the excavator thought, well, this must be a horse, because we know there were no camels here. Even though this horse has a big hump on its back, it has to be a figurine of a horse. It can't be a camel because camels weren't there that early. So that's good old circular reasoning that we're all guilty of once in a while. Scholars are no different than anybody else on this. Camels have been around since the creation. Why wouldn't the early desert people have domesticated and used these rather indispensable creatures in areas where there wasn't much water? All the evidence points to their limited use before and during the time of Abraham. Moses talked about gates, had a lot of knowledge about gates. For instance, in Deuteronomy 15, verse 22. This is a problem for some people. The phrase, "within thy gates," is used there. It occurs in the Pentateuch about 25 times. So the expression is sometimes used to refer to just the entrances to areas of dwelling. It doesn't have to mean literal gates. In Exodus 32, verse 26, Moses stood in the gate of the camp. Well, what does that mean? Was there a literal gate there, or is this the entry to the camp? The New King James Version just translates it as entrance, because a gate is a place for entrance. They certainly didn't have walls with gates around them. They were in a Bedouin-style type tent city. They didn't have walls with gates around them, but it doesn't have to be literal gates. It can be an entrance area. That's what the original word can refer to. Moses could have been referring to the cities that the Israelites would capture in the future. That's another possibility. But either way, the use of the term gates is not a problem. The Canaanites were then in the land, we read, and it's mentioned that they were there in Abraham's day. The reason I'm talking about whether Moses wrote the Pentateuch or not, I should ask the question, does it really matter who wrote the Pentateuch? Well, both Old Testament and New Testament writers claim that Moses wrote it, and that makes it important. In the Hebrew Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy was considered one single unit. Each book presupposes the book that precedes it. Without Genesis, Exodus reads like a book that just starts in the middle. Without Exodus, Leviticus is a complete mystery. We wouldn't know what was going on. So they really were five separate volumes in the same category. There were five divisions of the same book, and that's why it's called the Pentateuch. References to the law of Moses, or to the books of Moses. In the New Testament, Jesus himself said in Luke 24, verse 27, that we're told that beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto his disciples all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. The Bible is a book about Jesus. It's all about Jesus. That's why the Apostle John on the Isle of Patmos said that the spirit of prophecy is the witness of Jesus, Revelation 19:10. Because everything in the Bible is directly or indirectly about Jesus Christ. It's all about him. Anything that doesn't lead to Jesus has no validity. Anything that doesn't come from Jesus has no authority. So the Bible is all about him. But he said, beginning at Moses, that says ahead of time that those books were written by Moses. The Jews had a habitual practice of publicly reading the law. Acts 15:21. Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Who was read? It was Moses. So they all believed that Moses had written the Pentateuch, and there's no reason for us to disbelieve that. In fact, if we disbelieve it, we're disbelieving what Jesus himself believed. Again, in John 1:45, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Moses. Jesus says Moses allowed divorce because of the hardness of your hearts, and that's only in the book of Deuteronomy. In John chapter 5, verses 46 and 47, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, because he wrote of me. But if you don't believe the writings of Moses, then how will you believe my word? So when we claim that Moses did not write the Pentateuch, we're claiming that Jesus was mistaken. And if he was mistaken, he wasn't the Son of God. We can't believe in Jesus Christ without believing what Moses wrote. Jesus believed the Pentateuch, and we believe it too. We need to recognize that when we talk about miracles, and Jack just referenced this a while ago about the resurrection. And Jenny led a song about the resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus, we talked about the Gospels earlier in our session today. The resurrection of Jesus is attested by all four of the Gospel. It's the greatest miracle of all. If you have trouble with the issue of miracles, you might want to read C.S. Lewis's book about miracles, just called Miracles. There are a lot of insights in that little book. But the resurrection is the greatest miracle of all. There's no other explanation for what became of the body of Jesus Christ. If Jesus had not risen, the Jews would have easily proven it by producing his body. But he was declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead, Romans 1:4. That power has been displayed many times, but never with the magnificent completeness as in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And that same victorious power that raised Jesus Christ from the dead is the power that operates in his followers, you and me, today. That same resurrection power achieves in our lives a triumph over the dominion of evil. Let not sin, therefore, reign in your mortal bodies, that you may fulfill it in the lust thereof, because God gives you power over sin. When we look across all the centuries, and we look at the cross of Jesus Christ in the light of the resurrection, Then we see in Christ crucified the power and the wisdom of God. If Christ is the power of God, then the stories of the miracles in the Gospels appear natural and reasonable. We expect manifestations of divine power. If you're in Jesus Christ today, you have the same Spirit dwelling in you that raised Christ from the dead. It'll quicken your mortal body when the Lord comes for His own. If you're not in Christ, He has given you ample testimony in His Gospels, in His Bible as a whole, documents which have stood the test of time and which have passed all inspections with flying colors. Their witness is true, their witness is trustworthy, and their message is life-changing. So enjoy the promises of the Gospels, heed the warnings of the Gospels, and obey the commandments of the Gospel. The Son of God, who went down into that dim unknown of death and then returned to those people who knew Him best and could identify Him, brings the hope of the resurrection that can be found in no other place. And if you would become His child this morning, or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled brethren, let us know how we can assist you by coming to the front as we stand together. Denny's going to lead one more song.